His skin is white just like a ghost. Thick Irish roots and his blonde hair. And he sounds like a Chicago super fan. A music nerd with a collection of CDs from here to there. Yes, Andy Dare is in Chicago, interviewing and barbecuing. It's the Andy Dare Show. It's the Andy Dare Show.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for checking out the Andy Dare Show. This is our epic 98th episode. I'm joined by special guest Jack Endino. Also known as the Godfather of Grunge. He's a musical icon of mine and a huge fan. Not only a record producer and producing hundreds of classic albums throughout the years, also a musician in his own right, working on many of the albums, as well as being in bands like Skinyard and Jack Endino's Earthworm. He was totally a cool guy to take the time out of his day and speak with the little guy here, and it meant a lot to me. I have old memories of Jack Endino's sounds. This is a weird story, but back in 95, my first year of getting into music, I was really into the Nevermind album, and I was getting tapes at the time. So every week I'd go to the Coconuts Music Store and get a tape. And you only get one a week, so you better make it good. And the week after Nevermind, which I had almost worn out, I had played so much, I went and got Bleach. And it came in a black cassette, looked very ominous, very cool. And I put it on, and it did not sound anything like Nevermind. It sounded like a dingy, grungy, punk sound that I was not used to. My major label ears were not trained to the sounds of Jack Endino quite yet. And being an 11-year-old boy, tears came to my eyes to realize that I had to wait a whole nother week for another tape. Little did I know that I would grow to love Bleach, would grow to love In Utero, which I also thought that sounded weird too, because Albini put his own spin on it, you know, burying the vocals and whatnot. So, yes, as kids, we were trained to like the big bombastic sounds of Nevermind, Guns N' Roses, all that, you know, late 80s stuff that we were trained to listen to with our ears, but Jack Endino had something else going on, and he put his own personal stamp on Nirvana. He is a really cool guy for taking the time out. I just want to keep my spiel short today and just thank everybody who's gone through our Amazon banner at theandydareshow.com. On the right-hand side of the page, it takes you right to Amazon. You make your purchase. You spend zero extra cents, zero extra dollars, but you tip your cap to the Andy Dare Show and all the hard work we put in over here. And why not buy some of Endino's classics? Why not go on Amazon, pick up the Nirvana Bleach Deluxe? Why not you pick up Afghan Wigs up in it? Why not you check out the new Soundgarden Screaming Life reissue? How about Skinyard's own fist-sized chunks? There's literally are hundreds of albums that Endino has his hands on. So why not check it out? And while you're there, you can also check out Endino.com. He's got a lot of cool stuff up on there. Just want to thank Jack from the bottom of my heart for taking the time out. Meant a lot to an old rockhead like myself. So without further ado, my episode 98, Buzz Factory, with special guest Jack Endino. It's Andy. How you doing?
Good. Not a bad connection, I hope.
No, you're sounding great, actually. Thank you so much for taking the time out. I thought we'd do a little interview.
Yeah, okay. Let's do it. I got work to do today, but I got a little time right now, so go ahead, shoot.
Nice. I'm not sure if I'm worthy, but I'm thankful that you're taking the time out. We are recording a day after the passing of Lou Reed, age 71. Can you explain the influence he had on your recording career?
Pretty much zero in my case. I was never a big Velvet Underground fan. I was not a Lou Reed fan, so I'm really the wrong guy to ask.
Really, not even like the, I hate to bring the word up, grunge, but the way that they weren't really into polished sounds and especially White Light, White Heat, nothing?
No, it never just, the Velvet Underground never did anything for me.
Nice,
you know,
I get you.
God bless him. You know, as far as I can tell, he influenced a lot of people. Every time I hear the Strokes, or for that matter, Sonic Youth, I always think of the Velvet Underground, as well as a number of other bands. I mean, he influenced a lot of people from that that corner of the United States. The influence of the Velvet Underground pops up from time to time in other bands that I hear, and I always go, yep, they've listened to the Velvets. But it wasn't really part of my upbringing, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely more of an East Coast thing. Maybe that's the deal. You're up in the Pacific Northwest. It didn't really hit you as hard as it would have if you were in, you know, the Bronx or something like that, you know?
It didn't really. Their whole shtick didn't really resonate with my life particularly. You know what I mean?
And especially that double album with Metallica. That's sort of a bad swan song to leave out with, right? Yeah.
I kind of avoided that one.
Rightfully
so. I'm really curious in a sort of, you know, car wreck kind of way. I've always been kind of curious about it, but I kind of know what it probably sounds like anyway.
Yeah,
so
what you're
whatever.
Getting into. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I've been checking up on your Facebook. You went to some amazing shows lately. Couple guys just doing the acoustic thing, Mark Lanegan, and then you also saw Chris Cornell, just accompanied by acoustic guitars. It's kind of a different setting.
Lanegan was actually accompanied by electric. That was the interesting thing. It was voice and one electric guitar, nothing else.
Really weird.
Not acoustic. It was electric. And the electric guitar player, his name is Jeff Fielding or Fielder. You'd have to double check that, actually, because I've never met the guy, but he's really good.
Nice.
You know, he's badass. And, you know, Chris, on the other hand, just played by himself for the most part. Ben Shepherd got up and played bass with him on a couple of songs, but most of the set was just Chris and an acoustic. And he did have a few little effects pedals that he plugged into his acoustic in a couple of spots just to make it more interesting. But he pretty much held everybody's attention for 2 hours, which is freaky. Actually.
That's got to be tough to do with just a guitar and a voice.
He did it. That's what impressed me. I thought, wow, this is actually quite engrossing.
Are those two the greatest vocalists that you've ever worked with? I mean, it's hard to say that a voice is great compared to another voice, but definitely, I mean, you hear Lanegan from a mile away, you know it's Lanegan, you know?
Without a doubt. And now I love Lanegan's voice. I mean, you know, geez, I've worked on, what, two or three records with the guy.
Sure.
Three, four, something like that. And, you know, he's quite a guy. He's very moody, but, I mean, he's a charming fellow when you get to know him.
Nice.
You know?
And I got back into their early stuff, and he sounds about 18 years old, and he still has that, you know, like the basso muy profundo sound. You know, he must have hit puberty when he was 12.
Well, somewhat. It's not true. If you go back and listen to the Clairvoyance record, which is the very, 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 very first Screaming Trees record, you can tell he's younger.
Yeah.
The voice is a little higher.
A little Peter
Brady,
but
it's still Mark. I don't know. You know, it's not like, you know, you can tell it's Mark, actually, but definitely the tonality is not quite as rich. And also, you got to remember the other Screaming Trees guys used to contribute to a lot of backing vocals and stuff on those old records, although really the very first records for the most part. I mean, anyway.
Fair.
But yeah, Lanegan's quite a guy.
I felt like they could have kept their ball rolling past 1996. It seems like they released the album with the hit single on it in, what, 92? And then they took their sweet time with the follow-up. And by 96, you had all the Cobain wannabes, you know, all the Pumpkins wannabes, kind of, you know, diluted sound of grunge. And Screaming Trees were kind of the real deal still. But they couldn't really, you know, keep up the momentum. Or was it more of an infighting thing? I wasn't quite sure about the end of their story.
It was drugs and alcohol, basically. It was band dysfunction. People forget they only made three major label records. They made six or seven indie records before that. And pretty much established their reputation with those records on SST and then the one EP that was on Sub Pop. You know, at that point, they made Uncle Anesthesia, which was their major label debut, which is a kind of a not, it's not produced that well. It's all right. It's a little bit flat sounding.
And Cornell produced it, right?
It was Terry Date, really. But I mean, Chris was present in the studio for a little bit. His name got added to it, and he probably had something to do with it, but he wasn't like, you know, hands on producing it, really. He was there as a. You know, he had some kind of role, but he's not an engineer, you know what I mean? He wasn't responsible for the sound of it. The performances are good anyway. But it wasn't until the Sweet Oblivion record that they sort of had their little breakthrough. But then they only made one more major label record after that, and it was delayed by 4 years, as you said. So their momentum was pretty well squandered, and which is too bad, really, you know, because most people have never heard anything other than, you know, Nearly Lost You or the Sweet Oblivion record, and they haven't gone back and listened to Invisible Lantern or Buzz Factory or, you know, any of that old stuff that's really cool.
Those are their classics for me. The SST work is their best for me, at least, for sure.
Yeah, it kind of is.
Yeah, so how about like the most difficult album to record in your entire career? That like just painstakingly difficult with, I don't know, members fighting while you're trying to record, girlfriends being annoying in the studio or something. I don't know.
How about members dying? That happened to me with a band in Brazil called Titans that I made. I made my fourth record I made for the band in 2001. We had the rhythm guitarist, he died in a traffic accident on the first day of recording.
Jeez.
Well, I mean, he was in the hospital for a couple of days, but basically, that was it. He was done. And, I was down there for, I think, 8 weeks or something. It was this huge production that was scheduled, and we sort of, everything stopped for a week, and we had to do a funeral and everything, and the band had to decide if they were even going to continue.
Jeez, yeah, that's, that's heavy. Yeah.
And then at the end of the week, they came to me and they said, "Well, Jack, it's time for you to play guitar on a Titans record," because the other guitar player just said, "Well, I can't face playing Marcello's parts on this record. I just can't do it."
Wow.
And huh. I'd been there with them rehearsing. We had done demo versions of the songs. I mean, I knew all the guitar parts. So I ended up playing his guitar parts on about a little over half the record, actually. And that was a pretty hard record to make.
I'd say so.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And as things turned out, it became a huge hit record in Brazil and reestablished the band down there and blew everybody's mind. And, you know, it was mission accomplished. But, you know, it doesn't get much harder than that.
Yeah, that seems really crazy, and that's awesome that you were able to step up for them. You got a lot of stuff overseas and, you know, South America that you've recorded that I'm pretty unaware of. I'm going to have to go and check out Picas and, what was it, Guillotina?
T-I-T-I-S.
Oh, yeah,
T-I-T-I-S,
okay.
T-I-T-I-S. It's in Portuguese. I mean, it doesn't really get outside of Brazil and Portugal and whatever the remaining colonies are. This is the thing. I've done a lot of records in other countries and so forth, and they tend to be limited in their reach to the countries that, you know, that I work in, and they don't really affect my career here in the U.S. It's like I disappeared from the earth, really, as far as people here are concerned.
Yeah, that's got to be
but,
nice,
you know,
though,
that's
right?
All right.
Yeah. Huh? That's got to be nice every once in a while just to, like, kind of start with a blank slate in a different country with, you know, you're not the guy, the godfather of grunge, you know, you're doing your, I'm sure they know about that, but it's like.
Well, they do, believe me, but it's a whole different thing. The band might sound completely different, you know what I mean? And my friends back here in the U.S. would be like, "What is this? Like, we don't get this," you know, and I go, "I know, it's a different culture, sorry, you wouldn't get it."
You wouldn't get it, nice.
You know, and then Titans is like, their lyrics are a big part of it, and you can't make out what the lyrics are if you don't know Portuguese, and so it would just kind of go right past people here because there'd be a lot of cultural references.
Sure.
That are very Brazilian.
And hey, what kind of genre are we talking with them?
Rock, you know, basically, you know, rock with pop melodies, basically.
Okay.
You know, their songs have verses, choruses, and hooks, and, you know, sing-along parts, and, you know, there's strong singers in the band. Three different people who take turns doing the vocals. And,
yeah, I was picturing like Sepultura or something, but not so much.
No. It's not. No, it's the kind of stuff it actually gets on. They make singles. They get on Brazilian radio. Some of them are ballads. Some of them are pop tunes.
Huh.
Some of them are rock and roll.
Awesome.
You know, it's like a mainstream rock band, the kind of band that doesn't really exist in the United States at this point.
Yeah, at this point, not at all. You know, I watched the VMAs. Not even a one rock player, one rock guitar player, it seems like, in the entire show. So.
No, there's nobody, there's no mainstream big bands that are like that. I mean, you can only really compare them to something like The Who or R.E.M. or, you know, or U2 or something that's like, you know,
nice.
A band that is perceived to be a rock band because there's guitars that are turned up loud, but they're doing pop melodies. And pop songwriting style, you know what I mean? And,
nice.
You know, they're guys, they're kind of gruff and they're old and they're kind of grizzled looking. And, you know, they're perceived as a rock and roll band, but they write pop songs. So, you know, there aren't too many bands like that, or like none here in the U.S. that anybody really wants to hear. I mean, you know, think of like horrible bands like Nickelback or something that are basically fulfilling that role in you.
Sure, yeah.
In North America, you know what I mean? You don't really want to think about that. So,
no.
And, you know, those kind of bands usually only last for a year or two, and Pete Townshend has been around since 1983.
Whoa, kept it going, huh? Nice.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, they're kind of an institution. So it's you can't really compare it with, you know, me recording the latest, you know, punk band from down the street here in Seattle.
Sure.
It's a different ballgame.
How about, like, the most annoying, like, record label interference in your career, like, while recording an album? Was there anybody breathing down your neck, some sort of label, trying to change the sound of the album?
No, not really. I would say not. I've been lucky as far as that goes.
Pick your projects. Really annoying,
there haven't been too many annoying interactions. There have been a couple. I had a kind of an annoying interaction when working on a Babes in Toyland EP for a major label back in the 90s. And what... Yeah, you know what? I can't really... I'm not at liberty to speak of this because there was something going on that I didn't realize at the time. And it was... The band was not a happy band at the time.
Gotcha.
And the label was not a happy label, and they were asking me to do stuff, and I was like, well, I can't get the band to do that. They're not interested in doing it. You know, and I'm like the guy who's supposed to be like, you know, what am I supposed to be like?
The conduit.
Or something?
Yeah.
You don't do that with Kat, you know?
Some tough chicks.
No, you don't tell these girls what to do, and, you know, and I wasn't about to do that.
No.
So that weirded me out a little bit. So I've seen that happen a little bit. Most of the weird, you know, the indie bands that I sort of came up with in the scene that ended up with, you know, token major label deals in the 90s, most of their experiences were not necessarily that happy. You know, I'll refer you to a Melvins album called, I believe, Honky, which is the first indie record they did after they got released from their major label deal.
Sure.
And there's a song on there that is basically, I forget what it's called. It's pretty hilarious. It's like they did this ridiculous little pastiche, which is real or perhaps reconstructed phone messages from the label. Radio people don't know what to do with your record, you know, and just stuff like that. And it's freaking hysterical. And you just kind of, once you know the context, you just laugh.
That's great. Yeah. It was a weird moment, you know, when you had the Melvins, Babes in Toyland, all on major record labels in like 94, 95, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it made no sense to me. And, it, you know, in retrospect, it makes even less sense.
Yeah, the We Are Family cover, that was kind of a little forced by Babes of Toyland. Did you ever hear that one?
No, are you kidding me?
They did We Are Family. Swear to God, it's a B-side on one of their maxi CD singles, probably in 95. We Are Family,
serious?
The disco song. Yeah, that's why
what?
I thought maybe that one would have.
Are you kidding me?
I am not kidding you. I have it sitting right here. So you'll have to check that one out, Jack.
Is it any good?
No. Capital
they didn't,
N.
I mean, in other words, they didn't, like, do it with any sort of sarcasm or irony or anything like that. It's dead serious.
It seemed like a Luscious Jackson kind of trying to be, like, a little bit dancey, stuff like that at that moment. And, no,
see, that's the kind of nonsense that you would expect from a major label that's completely tone deaf.
Pretty much,
that pretty much destroys a band's credibility completely, you know. And they were not going to play that game, and I can see that they didn't. Interesting.
That is funny. How about like the first?
I kind of wish you could untell me that.
You're gonna wash your ears after this interview.
Yes.
How about like the first act that you recorded that was not from the Pacific Northwest? I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure actually.
Actually, it was from Philadelphia. Although, wait a minute. You say recorded, okay? Because I had bands come here and record with me who were not from the Pacific Northwest before I actually went somewhere else to record a band.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
You're talking about me leaving Seattle, or are you talking about bands from outside coming here?
The latter.
Okay, it could be any number of bands, because, you know, right off the bat, when the whole grunge thing blew up and Sub Pop was actually way before the grunge thing blew up and Sub Pop was just getting going, you know, they had their little singles club, and... you know, Sub Pop was, at that time, you know, 88, 89, they were mostly releasing Northwest bands on albums, but they had their little 7-inch singles club, which was a little wider in scope, and they would have, you know, if a band was coming through town that they liked, they would say, hey, you know, the morning, you know, the day after your gig, can you zip over to Reciprocal Recording and just cut a single with Jack before you drive off to Portland for your next show?
Nice.
So I ended up doing 7 inches during that period for, I think, Lubricated Goat did a 7-inch with me. I did a 7-inch for CZ Records with Babes in Toyland, I think, before I did the album for Twin Tone. There were quite a number of bands. I even did a Frightwig 7-inch, which never came out. Huh. What was that strange band from Australia that just got back together? The Cosmic Psychos did a 7-inch with me, which again also never came out. But there were a lot of others. And then the Fluid did an album with me. You know, they got signed to Sub Pop, but they were from Denver.
It was half you, half Butch Vig, right? That album?
Yeah, the Fluid. I did a record, and then Butch Vig did a record. And there was actually an earlier record that they recorded in Denver called Clear Black Paper that Sub Pop also put out.
Nice.
So, and then they ended up on Hollywood Records, which was Disney's major label record.
Yeah.
Their attempt at having a major label record, which of course was the end of their career. You know, typical.
It'll do it. Yep.
Yeah, that would do it. You know, so it's there's another story.
Well, how about like the Afghan Wigs? That was going to be my next question.
The Wiglets. That's right. The Wiglets.
A huge
okay.
Fan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love those guys. You know, they came to me. Now, the interesting thing about the Wigs, they had already put out an album of their own on their own Ultra Suede label. It's called Big Top Halloween, and you can't find it anywhere. Okay, and I'm sure the band has made.
I'm a diehard. Sure
the band has made sure that's the case. You don't know about it?
No, I'm a diehard, and I've searched high and low every record store I've been to. I've been to hundreds of stores, never found that one. I have every single thing.
You won't find it. Because I'm fairly sure that they probably drove around on their tour and bought up every copy they could find and made it disappear. I have a copy, actually.
Nice.
You know, it's basically there's a couple of tunes that they re-recorded later and a bunch of others they didn't. And, you know, it was recorded by themselves. I think John Curley, the bass player, at his little home Ultra Suede studio that he had. And then they did a 7-inch on Sub Pop, which I don't think I had anything to do with. And then they sent them to me to do the full album, which was up in it. And then after that, I did a couple of singles, Hey Cousin, Sister Brother, whatever.
Yeah.
They were delightful people, interesting people, I must say. Greg's a character, as you know.
Did they have like a Midwest feel about them? Or it was always weird how they brought the Motown to the grunge sound. That was definitely a first, right?
Well, remember that when I did them, they did not have the Motown vibe going. They were still a rock band. They were very much a Midwestern rock band with a sort of an interesting angle. The R&B thing had not quite...
You're right, yeah.
...focus. I listened to Up In It. It's very much a rock record, and it's, you know, he sort of went for the blue-eyed soul thing, actually, in the following records, actually.
It was more of a Minnesota sound, if I remember correctly. A little bit of a Replacements, Husker Du-ish blend for Up In It.
There was definitely, what was that other band from that area, you know, of Soul Asylum-y kind of thing. Yeah, it was that kind of vibe for sure, very Great Lakes. And I have to say, people here were kind of like a little puzzled, like at Sub Pop. It's like, why did you sign these guys? They don't sound like they belong on Sub Pop. But John Poneman was just very determined. He was a big fan. He really liked them, and I kind of liked them too. I said, well, yeah, they don't sound like a Northwest band. That's the point. They're not from the Northwest. You know, good for you, Sub Pop. You know,
hey.
I quite enjoyed that record, you know, but it doesn't sound like anything else they ever did.
No, and you're right about the soul influence coming in the later stuff, kind of when they went major too. And another band where they just kind of didn't strike while the iron's hot as far as, you know, capitalizing on the momentum. However, he's doing his own thing with Twilight Singers. He's got the, you know, the band with Mark Lanegan. They're the Gutter Twins.
Yeah, off and on. Yeah. It's sort of an occasional project that they do. I mean, you know, he's another guy. He's kind of like the Super Suckers that have, you know, sort of carved in, and the Melvins for that matter, that have kind of carved out their own little indie niche. And, you know, he can go tour when he wants to. So can Lanegan for that matter. I think he's on Beggar's Banquet or whatever, which is, you know, not really like a major label in the United States. But
not really an indie either. Yeah.
Not exactly an indie, not exactly a major, you know, but but he can go and like fill a theater anywhere he goes, really.
It's got to be nice and comfortable for them. They've hit a moment where they have their fan base, their diehards, they're willing to fill up these theaters, and they can tour when they want, they can record when they want, and they don't have the major labels breathing down their neck like they would in 1995, so...
Yeah, you know, at the same time, they're not. There's no danger of them making a giant impact on society with huge hit records at this point either. That option is pretty much off the table for almost almost everybody really, who's doing, you know, anything that is other than, you know, dance pop.
The Kings of Leon and EDM, yeah.
Yes, yeah, something like that, you know. So, but that's all right, you know. I mean, it's none of us really were trying to be big rock stars back in those days.
True. All right, I just got a couple more for you. I don't want to take up too much time here. How has social media helped rock and roll, or has it, in your opinion?
Well, it's the jury's out. It's made it. It certainly has made the whole thing about you know, getting your stuff available to people is easier than it's ever been. You know what I mean? Because, you know, the entire internet is basically a big shopping mall. And, you know, getting your stuff into digital distribution and so forth, making it available to people so they can download it and buy it if they want to, or steal it or whatever, it doesn't matter, it's available, is easier than it's ever been. The bottlenecks are gone as far as that goes, the gatekeepers. Now, the problem remains, capturing people's attention is harder than ever. That problem has never gone away. And that's the one thing that, in theory, labels were good for, was promotion. Capturing
sure.
people's attention. And that problem has still not been solved and probably won't be. I mean, it's there's no real alternative to getting out and playing a lot of live shows and just getting in people's faces physically. And a lot of people are not prepared to do that. And, you know, you don't really blame them.
Yeah, I mean,
US is freaking 6 or 7 weeks it takes to cover the U.S. and you'd have to do that 2 or 3 times a year. And not too many people want to do that.
No, not really. That's true, but yeah, you've gotten rid of the middleman, which is nice. Like you got your recordings on Bandcamp. You can get that your first album you recorded in 89, released in 1990. You got 3 records up on your Bandcamp, right? Your solo stuff?
Let me think, actually. I've got two of my 3 records up on Bandcamp right now, because the middle record is actually technically belongs to Greg Ginn. And I don't
gotcha.
Know if he would appreciate it. I don't know if he would appreciate me bootlegging it, although it's crossed my mind. But
after this whole flag and black flag, you know, crisis, right?
Yeah, you know, but I mean, you know, that's up. And there is a 12-inch that came out last year on a local label here called Finn Records. It's just 3 songs, and it's available from the finnrecords.com website. It's my rum. I covered the song Rumble, and a couple of originals are on there too.
Nice.
And people seem to like my take on Rumble. It's a bit of a closing the circle thing, you know what I mean? Who do I know that's like pre-grunge, pre-everything? Oh, Link Ray, what the hell, you know?
Link Ray, nice.
Yeah, you know, and it's pretty fun. We do a pretty freaking heavy version of it, you know. I just busted out some feedback and just went nuts on the guitar.
Awesome.
And it's a pretty guilty pleasure, really.
And you've always been like an early adapter of technology. It said that you had your website up in 97, and I go to your website, endino.com. Everybody should go check it out. I'm reading the frequently asked questions. You got everything from, if I'm in Seattle and I want to buy you a beer, is this possible? And then you go on for a couple paragraphs, and I just love that. I think that's very funny. And
it's everybody. It's literally frequently asked questions. I mean, I compiled those over about a decade because, you know, I would just get the same emails from people all the time. I'm doing a master's thesis on Grunge, you know, or whatever. You know, can I, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the FAQ really, like, thins the traffic down quite a bit because I can just refer to people. You know, here's what I think. You think I'm a jerk? Well, whatever, but here's what I think. You know, and people read it up front, and then it's basically makes it much more easy to deal with people because they pretty much know.
Pretty much know what's what you got.
What
going.
I stand for, and what I, you know, what I like to do, and what I don't like to do. You know what I mean? That's it's all about setting boundaries. It's like, no, I will not hold your hand. No, I will not get you a record deal. You know, yes, I will help you make a kick-ass rock record if you actually can play the songs. You know, and I will not find you backing musicians. I will not be your father figure in the studio. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, if you got your shit together, I can help you make a great record.
And that's, you know? I find you similar to my friend Steve Albini here in Chicago. Like, you know, no BS. Here's everything laid out for you. If you like it, we'll go with it. If not, I don't waste my time, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, Steve and I actually think a lot alike on a lot of things. There's some things he does not like to think of himself as a record producer, even though I think he is. He just refuses to accept it. You know,
sure.
I'm not afraid to say that. Look, I do more than just turn knobs. And, you know, I do have some judgment. I do have some experience. I am a musician. I will tell you when you're out of tune, you know.
And, sure.
you know, and it's I'm a little less afraid to exert my opinion if asked.
Sure. Yeah.
Steve is quite formal about that. He's quite he has a very well thought out philosophy about it, which is that I'm an engineer and I will stay out of the creative process entirely. And frankly, I've had enough people ask me to be involved in the creative process in some on some level, whether it's helping them arrange the tunes or, you know, trying to keep the, you know, come on, shorten it a little bit. You don't need to do 16 of those, do 12, you know.
Sure.
It's really things that to me are commonsensical that they, you know, sometimes they just need to hear it from somebody and they suddenly go, you know, I was thinking that too. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yep. That's what we should do. You know what I mean? Just sort of moving the process along a little bit in ways that it might not otherwise move along as quickly, but it's a judgment call.
Sure.
It's intuition and all that, you know what I mean? And I'm perfectly happy to just be an engineer when that's called upon. And half of my work is just mixing, for that matter. People just send me stuff from...
Mixing and mastering,
wherever,
yeah.
You know? Yeah, people just send me files from other countries, and, you know, I do it over the internet. It's okay, what do you think? Should I turn the vocal up? Okay.
Nice.
And the money appears in my PayPal account, you know, so... That's technology. You've got to love it.
Got to love it. 2013, I think it's better than it ever has been. It would have been real hard to get this interview in 1996. I'd have to send a letter to you or something. But I just appreciate you taking the time out of your day. I'm sure you're busy in the studio in a little bit. What can we look forward to next as far as an album you worked on being released or something that you're releasing yourself?
Well, you know what? I do a lot of archival stuff. You know, I have on my living room floor right now, I have an old Napalm Beach record that I just transferred off these multi-tracks from 1985. And I've offered to do some mixing on that and see what can be done with it because they're a Northwest band that I think was kind of overlooked. I've got some old Mono Men tapes that we're going to be doing some digging into, looking for old B-sides and things.
Nice.
I've got some old U-Men tapes sitting on my floor, actually, that we're going to be looking at for unreleased stuff. All of this is just hypothetical things. People give me the tapes, and then we decide what we're going to do. No master plans for any of this stuff. It's just all, like, people doing research, basically.
Oh, and I did...
Wait a minute, you know, we can't play these tapes. Well, we need to see what's on these, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And I'm like, well, yeah, okay. And, you know, I got my solo band. My own band is called Endino's Earthworm.
Sure.
And we have been playing gigs under that name for most of the past year. And at some point, probably in the spring, I will have an album called Set Yourself on Fire.
Nice.
Is
looking forward to
revised as we speak, actually. Yeah.
And, yeah, come to the Midwest, please.
Well, we'll see. You know, I don't know if touring is in the cards. I just
gotcha.
Don't. You know, the band members have got, like, families and shit.
Yeah.
So, what do you
I got gotcha. You. And the Screaming Life reissue, right, on Sub Pop coming. Is it that, like, for the holidays this coming soon?
Yeah, we just approved the vinyl test pressings literally just about a week ago.
Awesome.
So, I mean, it's on the way. It's been remastered. It sounds dramatically better than it used to. Dramatically better.
Wow, I can't wait for that. Yeah, thanks, Jack, for everything. I really want to thank you for taking the time out. Yeah, check out Endino.com, and all the stuff is on there. You could spend hours of your day checking out all the stuff he's worked on. Means a lot to me, Jack. Any last words?
Facebook.com/Jack Endino public page and Facebook.com/Endinos.earthworm.
Nice.
Just for the hell of it, you know, whatever. Oh. That seems to be where a lot of the action is these days, is over on Facebook. So
pretty much,
yep. Go.
All right, thanks. Alrighty. Jack. And on behalf of Jack Endino, this is Andy Dare signing off for The Andy Dare Show.
This episode of The Andy Dare Show is brought to you in part by Uncle Bub's award-winning barbecue in Westmont, Illinois. Family-owned and operated since 1997, Uncle Bub's is the real deal barbecue. A family-friendly restaurant open 7 days a week. Also, it's a full-service catering company doing weddings, pig roasts, luaus, grill packages, you name it. They have a friendly, helpful staff that will make sure that your party goes off without a hitch. Call them at 630-493-9000. Visit them at 132 South Cass Avenue in Westmount, Illinois, and UncleBubs.com.
Hey man, I know you like grilling. I know you like getting those dark grill marks on your burgers, fish, chicken. And I know you don't want to just dry your meat out like you're cooking with a hairdryer. Why not get the Man Grate and click through the AndyDareShow.com's banner so we can keep the lights on here at Honeycomb Hideout Studios in gorgeous Westmont, Illinois. The Man Grate.
This episode of the Andy Dare Show is brought to you in part by Record Utopia, a music lover's dream with thousands of vinyl records, musical instruments, and sound gear. They buy, sell, and trade. Give them a call at 630-963-1957. Visit them in Westmont, Illinois at 309 West Ogden Avenue, on the web at recordutopia.com. It's always a good, relaxed atmosphere. Check them out, Record Utopia. Be sure to follow Andy on Twitter, that's at Andy Dare, and like our show on Facebook, that's facebook.com/TheAndyDareShow. Videos at youtube.com/AndrewMartinDare, and we're on iTunes, just search The Andy Dare Show, please leave a review. Thanks so much to our wonderful sponsors, Uncle Bub's award-winning barbecue, Record Utopia, The Band Grate, and Amazon.com, theme song courtesy of Rich Banks Music. Thank you so much for checking out The Andy Dare Show. TheAndyDareShow.com.